You're listening to a Why Now podcast.
This is the Worldwide Will Show on whynow.co.uk. I'm your host, Will. I'm a British Army veteran of just short of 11 years and serve numerous tours of Afghanistan. In this show, I'll be speaking to former members of the British Armed Forces and Coalition Forces, giving them a platform of which to tell their life story, as well as experiences and how it's affected them. I hope you enjoy the show. Hey guys, welcome to the Worldwide Will Show. If you listen to this podcast before, you'll know it's a podcast designed in order to tell people's life story. I believe everyone's life is a story, and it's down to them to tell it. So today I'm joined by...
David Mahoney.
Thank you. Thank you very much for coming in. Really appreciate it.
Pleasure.
So, where did it all start? Where's Homestead?
So I grew up in London,
yep.
In Wembley, and I think by the age of 16, mm-hmm. as a result of council housing, mm-hmm. me and my three sisters and my one brother had moved between five different addresses, mm-hmm. and as a result, being the middle child, unfortunately, every time we moved, I was moved to the nearest school.
Yeah.
It resulted in me attending three different primary schools, three different secondary schools.
Wow.
So it meant that very early on, I'd struggled. Very disruptive. Although at the time, it felt completely normal to me. But looking back, I'd struggled to develop in the way that a young man would, mm-hmm. as much for that reason as because there was no positive role models in my life. My father wasn't around.
Yeah.
You know, we looked after ourselves. My mum worked incredibly hard. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So spent lots of time out of the house. And by the time I left school at 16, I sort of... I guess my IQ wasn't lacking, but mm-hmm. certainly my experience and my knowledge of the world mm-hmm. was. And so I wasn't aware of university.
Where were you in the family dynamic? Where were you? Were you the oldest sibling, youngest, middle?
So the middle sibling, two older sisters and a younger brother and a younger sister.
Yeah.
And I guess no one was close to... My brother was close to me in age, mm-hmm. but he had some mental... difficulties, psychological difficulties. Yep. So I was almost on my own, and there wasn't any sibling close to me in age. Mm-hmm. And so I left school, and I thought, well, the one thing we'd always struggled with was money growing up. So I have to go and get a job because a paycheck, well, that was going to make life mm-hmm. better than it had ever been.
Yeah.
And so I went straight into a job, and I think by the time I was 24, I'd maybe done 10 or 11 different jobs. And every time I'd secured a job, I would give it my all, but then I would always be looking for the next step up.
Sure.
And so, you know, I started in a jeans warehouse.
Would that be with a necessity to sort of provide?
To provide for myself, I guess. And money became, a security blanket for me.
Yeah.
And every time I moved up, I warehouse... you know, driving forklifts to packing boxes to then a postman to then eventually starting out as a highways inspector for Transport for London and working up to a project manager, which at the time I thought, you know, when I went into the company to begin with, I looked at the supervisor and I thought, that's cushy. They've got company cars, fuel cards, nice salaries.
Yeah.
You know, if I can get there, I will be happy. And mm-hmm. by this point, I think as a result of my inability to build friendships, maintain them, because, mm-hmm. you know, I'd never been in one place long enough to do it, I'd become very materialistic. I placed a lot of value in material things.
Yeah.
And so, of course, any money I earned never lasted very long because it was spent ridiculously on, God, in the early 2000s, Avisu jeans and, you know, Moschino shirts.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I remember moving into my own place and feeling more unhappy than I had ever felt.
Yeah.
I think life around me had fallen away. My closest friend was imprisoned for murder.
Yeah.
My brother faced a firearms charge. And the few friends I had left were either drug dealers or users.
Yeah.
Now, I'd always tried to do the right thing in my life, but always felt like at any, you know, something could easily go wrong for mm-hmm. me like it did for them because... Mm-hmm. Growing up in an area where crime was normalised, it's hard to see outside of that.
Yeah, 100%.
And it's funny because I joined the cadets at 14, and that was the first place that I saw I could be better and there were things that I was good at.
Yeah.
The cadet leader took a shining to me. And my initial plan when I left school was to join the army, but I was scared, mm-hmm. and I didn't feel like I was ready for that, and mm-hmm. so I forgot about it. And then at the age of 24, I remember driving down Wembley High Road on my way back to the office,
yeah.
seeing the careers office out the corner of my eye, and at that moment being so unhappy where I was in life
yeah.
that I three-point turned the car, parked up, went in and said, I want to join the army.
Wow.
And that was how it all started. And for me, it was about breaking the cycle. And I guess part of it was a cry for help mm-hmm, or, mm-hmm. you know, a form of escapism.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I knew that I needed to make that positive change because, you know, who knows what was going to happen
yeah.
next. And so I went in, and my nan, God bless her, when we were very young, took us to Buckingham Palace and we saw the foot guards. Mm-hmm. And so I always wanted to join the Irish Guards.
Yeah.
And I remember the careers officer looking at me, thinking, you're in a rush. Come yeah. back next yeah. week and let's have another discussion. And I yeah. was like, no, I need to start this process now.
Yeah.
And I said, I'd like to join the Irish Guards. And he happened to be an Irish Guard recruiter. And he said, well, there's a small problem with that is we're not recruiting for 6 months. And I remember feeling this panic in me, thinking mm-hmm, I wasn't sure that I had 6 months.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I said, well, what other London regiments are there? You know, at the time, I think Iraq and Afghanistan was going on, and I didn't feel a pull to that necessarily,
yep.
but I sort of felt like, well, as a young man, why should I sit on my sofa
mm-hmm.
from the comfort of safety, watching all of this go on and not, you know...
Do my bit. Yeah.
And so I asked what other London regiments there were. The only other one that was recruiting at the time was the Household Cavalry.
Yep.
And I said, what do they do? And he said, reconnaissance. I said, what's that? you know? And he said, it's sort of sneaking around. You spend a lot of time on the back of vehicles. And I yeah. thought, sounds perfect.
Yeah, yeah.
And so he gave me a few leaflets. And I remember looking at the leaflets on the bus home. And there was horses, and I thought, hold on a minute. You know, what is this, sneaking about or trotting around on horses? And I remember going back to see him, and he said, have you any experience riding horses? I said, I've never touched a horse.
Yeah.
And he said, well, there's no other London regiments recruiting. If you don't mind going up to, you know, Scotland yeah. or the Midlands, then or down south, we could find, I think RTR, he suggested,
right, yeah,
and I thought,
yeah.
I don't want to spend my life in a tank. No. I'd like to have the opportunity to do a bit of both. And the ceremonial side of it and then the armoured reconnaissance side of it,
mm-hmm.
I thought, well, it's the best of both worlds. He had said to me that I could go to the armoured regiment first. So I thought, well, you know, I'd love to do the ceremonial part, but let me go and do the army stuff first.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
then,
yeah.
you know, it would be a nice break from time to time. And I think I signed up in... I started the process in mid-January.
Right.
And then I was off for basic training in May that year. So pretty short and sharp.
Quite a quick turnaround.
I remember having never gone for a run and preparing for that selection weekend.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And trying to bring my mile and a half time down. And
that clock ticking.
yeah, and thinking, God, this feels like forever.
Yeah.
And I'd done okay on the selection. I was no athlete, but I passed all of the tests
yeah.
and the medical tests. And then May come around and off I went. Start of basic training.
Yeah. Was that straight to Catterick?
No, to Basingbourne.
Ah, right, okay.
See, I didn't at the time didn't understand the difference.
Sure.
The infantry training and mm-hmm. and looking back, I wish I had have experienced Catterick.
Right.
But actually, at the time, looking at who I was then, I'm not sure I would have been able to get through it.
Right.
Because, of course, Catterick is very different to
Basingbourne. Yeah, sure. Yeah.
But I don't regret, certainly, the decision because
yeah, yeah.
it's made me who I am today.
So you were quite... Were you the oldest in your sort of in your platoon?
So I joined
training?
At 24. So
yeah.
what I wasn't the oldest, but one of...
So you weren't the youngest.
Yeah, the one of the oldest, and I think while that was great in many aspects, because of my my social skills, mm-hmm. that, you know, I was far behind many of the younger recruits. Yeah. And actually, it's interesting that many of my best friends now said that when they first met me, they couldn't stand me. Not because I was a, you know, a horrible person, I just had this arrogant gaze to me. And, you know, I didn't speak to people because...
Yeah, yeah. Those social skills weren't there.
They weren't there. And, you know, I wasn't able to do it. Basic training was interesting. It while parts of it were tough, mm-hmm. parts of it were easy. I think growing up, the one thing our mum always did instill in us was, you know, making your bed, ironing, being clean. Mm-hmm. And so...
Self-maintenance.
So I thrived in that aspect, mm-hmm. whereas I struggled with the communication and the leadership and, you know, not being the grey man. And also the physical exercise.
Yeah.
And I think it was week 10, I remember phoning home and saying, I think I'm going to leave.
Mm.
And then it was that evening, I remember sitting thinking, and thank God I did, thinking to myself, well, what are you going home to?
Yeah, yeah.
That feeling came back to me.
Yeah, that initial feeling you had at the start.
Yeah, and with the feeling, the reason that I joined, and I thought, I can't fail at this.
No.
And that put a new wind in my sails.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it was funny, then a week later, I suffered a knee injury just before adventure training. And I couldn't walk on it. And so they bedded me down. I missed adventure training. They said, look, if it's not recovered by the end of the week, we're going to have to back troop you, which, of course, is...
No one, you know.
As great, as big of a man test as it is at that stage in your career, you know, at the time. Now, I think I could have done it. It wouldn't have been a problem.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But at the time, it was like, no, you can't do that. And I remember that feeling stayed with me that whole week. And no one else, the rest of the platoon, the section, they were gone on 18. So it was just me on my own. And it was a very uncomfortable week. And I remember waking up at the end of it, the day before they come back. And I was able to move my leg.
Mm.
And I thought... back in, you know, ready, you know, thank God, because I think we were only 2 weeks from pass out.
Oh, wow. Yeah, you don't want to get back.
No, not then.
No, definitely not.
And, and I finished at Basingbourne, mm-hmm. and then we had 6 weeks leave. Well, the Cav had 6 weeks leave, which was incredible. And I remember on the week before, someone from the Cav came in and we were cat badged.
Yeah.
And they gave me a lifeguard cat badge. So for those that don't know, the cavalry is made up of the Blues and Royals and the lifeguards. And the only difference between them is the colour of their uniform.
Yeah.
And I remember saying, I have to be a Blue and Royal. And he said, well, you don't have a choice, I'm afraid. And I said, well, and my decision to be a Blue and Royal, and thank God this happened, was the colour of the uniform. Yeah. I preferred the blue tunic to the red, because I thought, well, if I'm going to wear a red tunic,
might as well be the Guards.
It's going to remind me that, you know, my initial goal was to join the Irish Guards. And he said he can't do it. And I said, well, I'll put a transfer in. And then he said, okay, we'll move you to the Blue and Royals. And then he said, oh, by the way, you're going ceremonial first. And I said, hold on, excuse me. We were told that we could go and do the armoured side first. And he said, nope, every soldier has to go ceremonial. And at the time, I think, as a result of the training,
mm-hmm.
it was water off a duck's back. And I just said, okay, if that's what I've got to do to get there, then so be it.
Yeah.
And then that was it. I had 6 weeks leave and then rocked up at Windsor Barracks mm-hmm. to begin my khaki ride, which is 14 weeks learning to ride, groom and look after a horse.
Yeah. So my wife and I have two horses. I've never... had any experience of horses until she had, and when she was a child, I didn't. She was like, I really want a horse. So we live on a farm, so I have horses so with stables. So, okay, let's get a horse. Got a horse, and fucking hell. How much work goes into maintaining a horse?
It's like a baby.
Yeah. Unreal. And we take it in turns mucking out and turning out, and I'm just like, I don't even want a horse. Why am I mucking out at fucking 6:30 in the morning? But, but to be paid to learn A, how to ride a horse, but like the maintenance of horsemanship, I'd quite like that instead of having to do it for free at 6:30 before I go to work.
Well, I think it's something I've always really taken for granted.
Yeah.
But it was a baptism of fire.
Yeah.
We rocked up in the first morning. You know, they introduce you to the horses and they say, go into the stable. And these little tiny boxes, you know, not big stables, with the head out, the arse out. And you're thinking, you're looking at the legs thinking, if that kicks, I'm dead.
Yeah.
And then they tell you to go in. And, you know, I'm 6 foot two. And looking up at this horse thinking, you know, thinking,
this isn't
a donkey or a pony. Yeah. You know, these are, you know,
powerful beings.
Very big horse, you know, animals that I have no idea. You know, grooming them was one thing, you know, the constant fear of
them
pushing you around and kicking out and biting. And then the learning to ride, you know, it as tough as it was, it was untapped banter because, you know, when you're learning, when you're walking, it's all great. But then as soon as you start learning to trot and then going to canter and people start getting binned and the stories and thinking back, it evoked such positive emotions in me because it was like a Western film.
Do you feel maybe that helped your social side of things as well? Maybe
I think leaving basic training didn't really develop it. If anything, it, you know, I remained the grey man for many years even after leaving the army.
Right.
But then passing out and moving to Knightsbridge.
Yeah.
And, you know, being surrounded by, you know, officers that are very well to do. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it's the same in a lot of regiments, but, you know, you have to speak a certain way in the cab. You have to have a level of politeness and courtesy and decorum. And so it certainly started to develop there. And I, because of my admin, my ability to administrate myself very early on, when I got to Knightsbridge, you know, and there was the kit list was unreal. All of the kit you had to wear, but then the ceremonial kit, the horses kit, and everything else that was asked of you, it commanded a level of efficiency that I never knew I had in me.
Right.
But I did.
Yeah.
Amazingly, and I was very quickly snapped up as a corporal of horses orderly. So that meant that I had done one silly season and then I started looking after him and turning him out. So I no longer had to ride on any of the escorts or do guards, which was a gift in the cav. I tell a lot of people that time off in the cavalry is given in hours, not days. So 36-hour leave or 48-hour leave. And you're lucky if you get a weekend off a month.
Wow.
Because the horses come first and they've got 300 of them in Knightsbridge. And not enough men, you know. And so I'd sort of found my niche as in, you know, I'm good here, you know, I'm good at this.
Yeah.
And we were always told that in Knightsbridge, you know, if you're able to apply yourself when you move to Windsor, it will make you better at the green stuff. Mm-hmm. It's something different and you're going to have to learn it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But the qualities that help you survive and be successful here will work anywhere. Yeah. And I then was given the opportunity to become the orderly for the corporal major.
Right.
Which was sort of seen as the Bakshi role in the cavalry mounted regiment. And there was only two of them up for grabs. And an incredible man came in. His name's Paddy Ireland. I was told very early on that he was known as the soldier of his generation, a straight shooter who you didn't cross the line with.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, okay, well, I've had to up my game. I'm going to have to up it even further. Yeah. I don't know how, but, you know, I'm going to have to do whatever it takes to get it done to make sure that he's happy. And he came in and he was sort of, out after the cadet leader, he was the second male role model in my life who I sort of looked up to and admired for his professionalism and, you know, the way he carried himself, what he expected of himself, but also what he expected of others. And so that took me to a completely new level.
So he tends to mould yourself similar to the way he...
Pretty off him. I mean, I, you know, he, like me, was a very good trooper as far as administrating himself. Mm-hmm. I wasn't, you know, the fittest soldier. I wasn't anywhere near the fittest soldier. Yep. I wasn't, you know, I wasn't a leader.
Yeah.
You know, I still wasn't great with communication skills and you know, outwardly facing. But I was building myself, I guess, from the bottom up. And And then after, I think I'd worked for him for about a year and a half. Mm-hmm. And then I just had my first boxing match within the regiment, which was, again...
An experience.
I lost on split decision, but, you know, that feeling of getting pinged in a ring and, you know, the world spinning around you and thinking, I need to stay up. I can't go down in front of the lads. It's not going to happen. You know, that was an experience in itself. And then the British Army boxed the US Army in the Royal Albert Hall at an event. And my boss had said, you know, there's an opportunity here. Would you like to come along? There's some officers going and a couple of troopers.
Yeah.
And I thought, great opportunity. Why not?
Yeah, yeah.
And so off I went. And then leaving the Royal Albert Hall, I don't remember leaving the Royal Albert Hall. And that was sort of where life for me was turned upside down. And
right. Took a change.
I was stripped back completely and, and, you know, for the first time, had absolutely no control over what was going to happen next.
Right. Do you find that the incident that we're about to talk about, do you find that if it hadn't happened, would you be in a better place than you are now? Or do you not really look at the situation like that? Do you just look at what you're dealing with right now and say, well, this is the this is the life that it is and I'm carving a new path now?
I think not so much the accident, mm-hmm. but certainly, you know, some of the darker stages, periods after the accident, are what I reflect on and think, you know, overcoming that was, you know, my injury, overcoming that was easy for me. It was difficult for my family and for now Captain Ireland, who had to pull me from beneath a vehicle and...
Yeah.
You know, I fell asleep one day and woke up 8 weeks later and was just ready to crack on.
Yeah,
what happened after that, once I left the army, that was the real baptism for me, because there wasn't anyone to help me.
Yeah. What was... At the accident, you said you sort of... It's like you went to sleep and woke up 8 weeks later. What was the injuries you sustained?
So there's a vehicle hit me while crossing the road outside of the barracks, and I'd been pulled beneath the vehicle.
Fucking hell.
And Captain Ireland spun around, obviously hearing it, but not being able to see me. And I think the taxi then decided to pull over, and it was only that someone else on the other side of the road had said stop. They could see me beneath the vehicle. It just so happened that, being a military event, everyone was filtering either back to the barracks or to the station. And I had, well, Captain Ireland says that, you know, as he pulled me from the wheel arch, I was completely non-responsive. He said that, you know, having seen, you know, people after following IED incidents and gunshot wounds, he's never seen so much blood pouring from ears, nose and eyes. And and he was sure that I was gone.
Yeah.
You know, that I think they had to... He tried his very best to stabilise me. I was very... And he was very fortunate that after he had initially stabilised me, he got a tap on the shoulder and there was a medic who then said, let me get on him. And then when the ambulance arrived, he had another tap on his shoulder, and it was an SF colonel surgeon who said, let me in. You know, and what are the chances of that?
The wealth of knowledge that's right there, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think the ambulance, they knew I'd suffered a brain injury. They didn't know how severe at the time.
Mm-hmm. And you recall none of this?
No, absolutely not. I think my last memory was maybe 2 hours before leaving.
Oh, wow.
And I think the ambulance wanted to resuscitate me into hospital.
Yeah.
But the surgeon colonel had said, not a chance, he's a soldier. Mm-hmm. We're going to induce a coma at the scene.
Yeah.
And I didn't understand at the time why they'd done that, but it's essentially put me into recovery mode.
Yeah.
And apparently very common.
It's almost like a reset button.
In Afghan and with injuries that they'll put you out because it puts your body into sleep mode.
Yeah.
And so I was in a coma for 4 weeks. I think from hearing my family, they said that the doctors had given me no hope and had
Really?
Had spoken about suggesting that they switch my life support off.
Fucking hell.
And of course, my family grieving,
yep.
You know, weren't ready to do that weeks in.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think my condition, if it couldn't deteriorate anymore, it did. They then said, we need to rush him in for surgery. Mm-hmm. And as they're saying this to my family, they're wheeling me out past the meeting room, quickly say your goodbyes. We need to remove the right hand side of his skull. Mm-hmm. It's unlikely he'll survive the surgery, but there's nothing else we can do.
Yeah.
And my mum collapsed to the floor at the time. And a funny story is that I think he's now half Colonel T.A., who's the Queen's equerry,
mm-hmm.
who was my squadron leader at the time and got in the ambulance with me. He apparently picked my mum up off of the floor and shook her violently and said, get a grip.
Wow.
He's a household cavalryman and he's going to pull through this.
Yeah, yeah.
And my mum still says to this day that if it wasn't for him and the morale he brought
mm-hmm.
to the hospital,
mm-hmm.
she would have had a heart attack and ended up in hospital.
Yeah.
And I survived the surgery and they said, okay, look, he's alive, but we're going to have to attempt to bring him out of the coma. And
yeah.
if we can, he's going to be in a vegetative state.
Yeah, we don't know what we're going to be left with.
Well, they said the injuries, the bleeds to the different parts of my brain meant mm-hmm. that any form of life for me was near on impossible. I think the injury was described as having a mortality rate of 97%.
Fucking hell.
And so my family, of course, as you would, you know, had consoled themselves and said, yep. well, if that's the way he is, that's the way he is. We just want him back.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then they attempted to bring me from the coma. And it's apparently done in a slow process where mm-hmm. they count you down and slowly reduce the sedation.
Yep.
And so you slowly come out. And what apparently was happening, as soon as they'd even slightly reduced the sedation, my body would jump to life and I would start, you know, screaming and shouting and kicking and legs flailing. And they'd have to induce me back sure. in.
And then try and creep it again.
And try. And I think they'd three or four times, apparently, they tried.
Is that a common thing with TBIs and stuff like that?
I'm not too sure if that is. I've never asked that question.
Yeah.
But when they eventually brought me around and they took me off of high dependency,
yeah.
I have no real memory. I was very much in autopilot the next 3 weeks because yeah. I don't have any memory. And the army were... My regiment was super supportive and they would ferry friends up.
That's good.
To the hospital and they yeah. were, you know, their dark humour that at the time my family didn't understand.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Now we look back on and we laugh and, you know, the stories they have of, you know, I was sure that I'd lost my legs. And they said, David, yeah, your legs are here. They would touch them, look. And I'm like, no, they're not. But they'd say, you know, we're going to get some bits from your room back at the barracks. You mm-hmm. want us to bring anything? Or can you bring my prosthetic feet? And they're like, your feet are here, you madman. What are you on? my first memory was being told by the nurse, because I could see the toilet and I had a catheter in at the time. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, why can't I just go and use the toilet?
Well, it's good that you have the association of going to the toilet and pissing in the toilet to start with.
Well, yeah, and... I remember wrapping the catheter around my arm and saying, take it out.
Yeah.
And they were like, we can't. You can't get out of bed. And I was started pulling and everyone's going.
Oh, my God.
I remember, I'm sure my mum was heaving. And the nurse went, no, stop. We'll take it out.
Yeah.
And so they took it out, they still said. And then the nurse said, you can't go to the toilet because you can't walk. And I said, what do you mean I can't walk? Stand at the bottom of my bed and I bet I can kick you.
Mm.
I was very aggressive, mm-hmm. and I still, although I remember it, it wasn't me.
Sure.
You know, it was something inside
yeah.
of me.
Yeah.
And she said, no, you've been in bed for so long, and as a result of your brain injury, you're not going to be able to walk. Yeah. At the time, the hole that they had cut, it had allowed my brain to swell out,
mm-hmm.
and,
mm-hmm.
you know, I was completely oblivious to sure. that. So the last thing they wanted me doing was trying to walk. And what I had to do was ring a bell when I wanted to go to the toilet and they would bring a cardboard box and I'd have to roll myself over, go into the cardboard box and then ring the bell. The nurse would come back, draw the curtains and take it. And it was the most frustrating thing, mm-hmm. being able to see people coming and going from this toilet and being told, you can't. You know, mm-hmm. I've just spent mm-hmm. the last, you know, 4 years of my life telling myself and showing myself I can.
I can, yeah, sure.
And then I realised in the evenings that the nurse used to fall asleep on the night shift. And there was a guy opposite me who was in like a full upper body cast. And yeah. He couldn't move his arms, but he could move his eyes.
Yeah.
And so I would say to him, is she asleep? Look right and left. And his eyes would ping right and left. And because he could see his death.
It's all like a great escape.
From where he was. And then what I would do was I'd pull myself out from the bed. And I remember the first time I'd done it, standing on my feet. And I had this vision of, you know, you take a newborn and you hold them on their feet and their legs are going all over the place. That was what was happening to me. And I couldn't fathom. I was thinking, what?
Yeah.
No one had it. Someone had probably explained it to me, but I wasn't able to compute.
Mm-hmm.
And so every night I would pull myself from bed and each time building up a little bit more strength. They didn't want to rehab me because of the brain being swollen.
Sure.
And of course.
Yeah, and you having none of it.
And yeah, and so every night I'd done that until one, I don't know how long it took me, but I let go of the bed and I was able to stand up and I was sort of wobbling like one of those toys that wobbles.
Yeah.
And I thought, I can make the toilet, I'm going to go for it. And she's asleep and so it was like a Maggie from The Simpsons walking over to the bathroom. And I got into the bathroom and I stood there going to the toilet with the first time I smiled since waking up,
mm-hmm.
feeling this sense of achievement of I'm okay,
yeah.
You know, I'm all right. Doesn't matter what the doctors are saying or that I don't remember what day it is, okay.
Yeah. Well, the fact that they kept saying you can't and you just said, well, I fucking can, watch this.
Yeah. And it wasn't even about proving them wrong. Sure. It was about proving me. Yourself.
Yeah.
And then as I turned around and come out of this, you know, toilet, the nurse was standing there and it was an African lady, bless her, and she was screaming at me, you're gonna kill yourself, what are you doing? And then I looked straight to the guy in the chest brace and he was looking at me as if to say, laughing is hurting, I need to stop laughing but I can't. It's almost like we had this mental thing.
Yeah.
And then she called Major TA at the time to come up,
mm-hmm.
like, you need to tell him, he's going to kill himself. And I remember him sitting down and saying to me, David, what's going on? Mm-hmm. Like, they're telling me you're trying to escape from the hospital. Why are you packing a bag and
mm-hmm.
and trying to make for the stairs? And I said, I'm not. I'm just, they won't rehab me.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to do it myself. So I would put a day sack on and walk around this sort of O-shaped ward that mm-hmm. had a desk in the middle. Just to do something, just to progress. And they thought that was me trying to escape.
Right.
And he said, look, I'm not going to tell you to stop. You're a soldier and I would expect this of you, but, you know, be careful. And I think a couple of weeks later, I was then moved straight to Headley Court.
Mm-hmm.
And that was weird because I'd heard of Headley Court, but
You haven't any experience of it.
I never thought what it was. And
no one does until they either been there or know someone that's been there.
And I remember getting there and being put onto the neuro ward and looking around me. And I'd been stripped back.
Sure.
All of the work I'd done to build, you know, my communication, my confidence, it wasn't there anymore and mm-hmm. I couldn't call on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember sitting down with the team, I think the following morning, and they sort of, you know, it was this cuddly, fluffy, okay, how are you, David?
Mm-hmm.
So tell us what's wrong and how we can help. And I remember sat there, not arrogantly, but thinking, and I actually said, there's nothing wrong with me and I'll be home by Christmas. You know, I didn't want to be there as much because I'd been run over by a vehicle mm-hmm. and I'm surrounded by people who have, you know, lost limbs and,
mm-hmm.
you know, had injuries on tours. And I felt like a bit of a fraud.
Unworthy of being there.
Yeah, I guess. And they sort of, you know, ha ha, very funny, David. I'm sure you will be home by Christmas. And I could sense that, you know, he's in a bad place if he really thinks that. Because I think they'd scheduled me in based on my injury for 12 months.
Oh, wow.
Of rehab.
It's a long time.
And I spent just short of 2 months, and then I was released on Christmas Eve and they said, you're ready to go home.
You're right.
Well, yeah, I mean, there were cognitive issues, but I was doing okay or doing enough.
Well, it sounds like you ticked the boxes in order to be released.
Yeah, and so they said, at this point, I still had the massive gaping hole in my head. And they said, look, you need to go home. It's going to take, they're not going to operate for 8 or 10 months. Go home and stay there.
Yeah.
Until you're contacted to come in for surgery.
Yeah.
And I was sort of, I remember thinking, what am I supposed to do for 8 months? Yeah. All I wanted to do was get back to Knightsbridge.
Sure. Yeah.
And get amongst the lads and back into the, you know, start serving mm-hmm. my regiment. And
mm-hmm.
and I knew that the plan was for me to post to the armoured regiment.
Yeah.
I was actually supposed to get promoted. I'd just come off of the board while I was in hospital.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then I think Herrick 12 was happening at the time. And
right.
I was, just before I was run over, my boss always says that he was nagging me about going to me posting into Afghan.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was, you know, I'd done the ceremonial side, I'd moved on.
Yep.
I wanted to go over and experience that and do my bit. And so staying at home for 8 months, you know, wasn't an option. And
yeah.
I think I spent 2 weeks at home, Christmas, New Year came round, and I'd moved in with my sister at the time, who, bless her, it can't have been easy, because every time she'd hear me turn in the night, she'd get up.
Mm-hmm. Make sure you're okay.
Because, of course, if I had turned onto that side of my head, it could have easily caused a bleed.
Yeah.
And I said, I'm moving back to the barracks. And she was, what do you mean you're moving back to the barracks? You know, I think she developed a sort of codependency thing to me. And I said, I can't stay here. And off I went back to the barracks. And I then started presenting myself to the med center every Monday saying, I need something to do. Give me something.
Yeah.
Give me some purpose. And they were like, health and safety, you know, we can't have you here. If something happens to you, you know, if something hits your head, it's not a case of, you know, a bruise or a scratch. It's a case of life and death.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I said, well, just...
So why wouldn't they bring your operation date forward?
So I think because of the severity of the bleeding to the brain, they leave it open. Or not open. I mean, they cut maybe the hole if you stretch your palm out.
Uh-huh.
The circumference of your fingers,
yeah,
to allow the pressure that had built up on the brain as a result of the bleeding to release.
So I'm guessing this swelling was still there at that point.
No, so by the time I went to Headley Court,
the
swelling it had subsided, and I was left with a dent.
A dent, yeah.
Effectively,
yeah.
A funny story. I think it was after about a week in Headley Court, I woke up one morning and went to do my morning routine and looked in the mirror. My head was normal. And I almost collapsed and I was screaming. I pulled the alarm bell so hard, I think it pulled it off of the ceiling. And the nurses come running in. They said, what's wrong? I said, get me the consultant.
Yeah.
And she come running down. What's wrong, David? I said, look, what do you mean what's wrong? My brain's swelling out again. She said, no, relax, David. In the mornings, as a result of laying down, the fluid settles.
Right.
So that when I get up, it looks normal.
Yeah.
But then as the hours pass, it dips back down again. And so I was like, how did I not see that 2 weeks ago when I was here? Why have I only learning this now?
Yeah.
And so, they'd leave me like that. And I understood why the army didn't want me to come back to work, but I felt like I needed to fight. I needed to show that nothing was any different.
Sure.
You know, I believed that, you know, I could just crack on and I was no different.
Probably not to show them, but to show yourself as well.
A bit to show myself, but I think also, you know, there was that level of feeling like I was letting the team down and, you know, being away and... the autopilot in me, and I think what the army had created in me was just get back.
Yep.
You know, you sit around too long, you know, you're going to go sideways. And they eventually got me a job in a store. And I tried a couple of, I remember doing the the risk assessment, and they're like, it needs to be something that was nothing above shoulder height. And I was just like, well, look, fair enough, I can't go to the stables, but just give me anything else. Yeah, yeah, and they moved me around. And it started, I think, 1 hour a day, 4 days a week. And then I'd go back the next week. Mm-hmm. I want more. Mm-hmm. I want more. Mm-hmm. And I got up to 4 days, 4 hours a week. And I was able to pass all of the physical tests. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't allow me to go on CFTs and PFAs, sure. But some of the PTIs who I was friends with, I would say, look, will you come out? I'm going to go and do a CFT in the park. Yeah. Will you come out with me? And they're like, half your head's missing. You can't run around high part of a Bergen on your back. And I was like, well, I need to.
Yeah.
I need to know that I can do this stuff. And so while I was thriving in that sense, psychologically, I wasn't sharp. You know, things I could do before my injury, simple things like counting, you know, something in a box. Now I did 4 or 5 times. It would take
a lot of concentration in order to do that as well.
And I would then notice that I was, after 4 hours of work, I was burnt out.
Yeah.
And to begin with, I just put it down to sort of, this is me just getting back into the swing of things. Mm-hmm. It was almost as if I disregarded everything Headley Court had said to me.
Yeah.
And there wasn't a doubt in my mind that I was 100% and I could give 100%.
Yeah.
And then I think I started to experience anxiety and depression, but at the time I didn't know it was that. I started playing fruit machines an awful lot in the barracks, which I'd never done.
Yeah.
And my sister, who used to sort of help me with my money, she had said, maybe you need to get help for this. And my response was, I'm just living life.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, I was drinking an awful lot. And then when the club would close, I would go to the casino. And when the casino would close, I would walk back to the barracks and then stop at another casino. And on reflection, what I was doing was, I didn't have a gambling problem or a drinking problem, because I wouldn't drink at home and I wouldn't gamble online or anything like that or go into bookies. But it was about not going back to reality and staying numb, because waking up in the morning, you know, it was almost as if I consciously was blind, but subconsciously, you know, could see everything that was going on. Uh-huh. And I remember going back to see the MO and saying, I'm struggling with my fatigue. And I didn't speak about the anxiety and the depression because I didn't know it was that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he then sent me back to Headley Court, and I had a load of psych evaluation, and it didn't do anything to help me.
Right.
Because I then went back to the barracks and carried on again.
Yeah, yeah.
Doing this all. And then I think I'd started working more hours. You know, the army sometimes commanded a little bit more from me than the doctors said I could give.
Yeah.
And me wanting to prove myself. You know, I'd done that. So early morning rehearsals, I would muck in and help where I could. And I found success initially, because I was selected to march the Great Britain flag out at the opening ceremony of the Paralympics.
Oh, wow.
Which again gave me purpose and was a sign that, okay, I'm moving in the right direction, albeit a new one. Mm-hmm. And what was interesting was, I'd done all the rehearsals with my skull missing. And I always thought to myself, well, the operation's going to come after the ceremony, so I don't need to worry about that. And because no one else seemed to be worried about it. And we were commanded by a Navy officer who wasn't particularly sharp, and the Navy lads that he had were horrendously TikTok-ing. And I remember him saying, for some reason he picked me, and he said, Mahoney, get up at the front, I want you as right-hand marker, you can march. And I thought, okay, perfect.
Yeah.
We'd done all the rehearsals, and then 2 weeks before the opening ceremony, my surgeon called and said, we're ready for you to come in for brain surgery. And I was thinking, this is great, because I'm going to be able to wear a headdress. Mm-hmm. Because as it stood, I would have had to have elasticated my peaked cap to my head. But then I thought, if the army find out this is going to happen, and which of course they're going to, they're going to pull me from the event. They're not going to let me do that. I said, how long's the recovery time? And he said, you want to take it very easy for at least 6 weeks. Mm. I thought, I can't do that. And so this military thing kicked in me that, you know, you need to find a way to get this done.
Sure.
You can't let this go.
That was your mission.
Mm. You need to achieve it.
Yeah.
And so I thought, let me see if I can pull the wool over the Navy officer first. And I said, I've got a medical appointment I need to do up in the Midlands.
to put it lightly.
And because of my injury, I need to give myself a couple of days either side to travel. And yeah. I'd never compensated for my injury.
Yeah.
And I guess I'd done it sort of blindly. And he was like, look, I'm happy. You know the drill and the job.
Yeah.
Go away and we'll see you on the opening night. And then I thought, okay, I'm not going to mention it to the MO at my regiment or anyone at my regiment and just see if anyone pulls me up about it.
Yeah, yeah.
And no one did. And so I then went away. I had brain surgery, reconstructive brain surgery. And I remember waking up from recovery and the surgeon, Dr. Holmes, was an incredible man.
Yeah.
And I remember saying to him, everything okay? Good to go? And he was like, yeah, you're fighting fit. And so I got up out of bed and I started packing the few bits I had into a Tesco's bag.
Yeah.
I just sort of tipped my lunch onto the bed and was like, I need to get home because I need to square myself away for the opening ceremony. Yeah. He was like, stop.
What are you doing?
What on earth are you doing? I was like, well, I've got an opening ceremony to do. And he knew about the ceremonies. My sister had contacted him and said, the opening ceremony is coming up. You know, I know he's worried about not being able to wear a headdress. Mm-hmm. Can you bring the op forward? And he said, no, you've got a drip hanging from the back of your head. And I sort of looked in my peripheral vision and there was this pipe coming out the back of my skull and down into this sort of liter bottle and there was just blood.
Shit.
Pinging down into it. And I was sort of like, do I have to take this home with me?
Yeah.
And he was like, no, you need to stay in hospital.
Have you got a backpack for this? I'll just take it with me.
You need to stay in hospital until we pull it out. And I said, well, how long is that going to take? And he said, well, it could be anything from a day to 4 days. And I said, well, the opening ceremony is in 2 days. And he said, look, if you do nothing but rest, I would say there's a pretty good chance that you'll be ready to leave by then. And so I thought, okay. I pinned myself to my bed.
Yeah.
And then it was horrible. Two awake days in hospital it was good but easy when I was in my coma because I wasn't with it.
Yeah.
But here I was pretty corpus mentis and I was just thinking it felt like a lifetime. And they took it out that day and I remember I went home that day and then the following evening was the opening ceremony and I remember looking at myself in the mirror. I'd got a haircut before the up, knowing that they were going to shave one side of my head.
Sure.
I had a shave, and I sort of thought there were stitches, because the scar runs from my ear up to the side of my head and down the centre. And so I said to my sister Kelly, who's a nurse, will you cut the ends of those stitches off, because that's going to give away the game. They were probably about 2 inches long. Hanging out the side of my head. And she said, no, I'm not doing that. They're like that for a reason. And I said, okay, well, look, I'm just going to rock up to the stadium. If anyone notices, I knew they didn't have the spare people there on the night.
Yeah, so they have to roll with it.
So they have to roll with it.
Yeah.
And, I rocked up to the Olympic Park and it was the most unbelievable feeling. The buzz was insane.
Mm.
And we were put into this little room and I remember everything was keep people to your left-hand side. Don't let them see the right.
Mm-hmm.
And then the moment come and we marched the flag out. And I remember thinking at that time, you know, if I can achieve this, then whatever happens next, I can get through.
Uh-huh.
And it was sort of, I think, a couple of months after that, that the MO sat down with me and said, look, you're trying your hardest. And physically, you're where you need to be.
Mm-hmm.
But mentally, you know, at some point, you're going to have to start thinking about, you know, life for David outside of the army. Yeah. You know, he said, you know, I would love to put you in a stores role or something like that. He said, but I know that you won't be happy.
Yeah.
And I said, well, would that mean I was undeployable? And he said, yes. And I said, well, you know, it will kill me to stay in the army.
Yep.
And be undeployable. And he said, so look, let's get you in front of the doctor and, you know, start thinking about what you're going to do next. Mm-hmm. And I think within a few weeks, I was in front of a med board and they said, okay, med discharge. And they said, they gave me 8 months. And I thought, that's plenty of time. You know, I can square myself away. And I qualified in that time as a swimming instructor because Headley Court, the only notice I took of them was that they said I wanted to be a PA and they said, no, you're not going to be able to do it. You can't work full time. Yeah. You need to work flexibly. I wanted to be a PE teacher. They said, you're not going to be able to go to university because you're not going to be able to give cognitively that much for such a long period of time. But a swimming teacher, the training's short, you know, there's ample work out there. Mm-hmm. And so I sort of thought, okay, well, I'll do that. And I started working as a swim teacher before, a couple of months before I left. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't hard to find work and I was enjoying it. But the moment I left, things sort of changed and I started to, suddenly I had so much more to think about in life.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the army is a gift. You have, you know, you don't have to think about bills. You don't have to think about food.
You're
shopping,
very well looked after. You're maintained.
Yeah. You know, you just have to do your job. Yeah. Go put yourself to bed at night
and wake
yourself
up
and go and do your job. And I started to notice that I was forgetting the children's names very early on and when they would rock up for their lessons. And then it slowly got worse and I then started to forget their abilities. So I would, they'd come in and I developed strategies. Mm-hmm. So I'd put tags on them. So Jonathan, come on, we're going to get in the deep end today. And he'd look at me, this sense of fear, and then look over at his parents. But David, we've not even got into the middle part of the pool yet.
Yeah.
And I'd, are you sure? Are you playing games?
Yeah.
And I'd look at a whiteboard and I'd be like, fuck, you know, he's, you know. And I started to feel not only was I letting the child down, but I was letting the parents down. Because I was thinking if I was sending my child to a swim teacher, you know, I would be slightly concerned in this position. And I knew that I was a very good swim teacher. I used to literally, like we would get beasted in PT in the army, I would beast the children in the pool.
Yeah, yeah.
And the parents would say, it's great, he falls asleep when he gets home. You know.
Yeah. Keep doing it.
Yeah. But they didn't know about the problems that I was having. And so I then reached out started looking at other roles that I could possibly do and the opportunity to go and drive for an individual 5 days a week presented itself and I thought, you know, I can't do the swim teaching. It was killing me.
Yeah.
And I took on the job full time again thinking, what do the doctors know? Of course I can work full time. It won't be a problem. It's just driving.
Yeah.
And then after about 2 or 3 months, I sort of crashed and burned. Now the abusing alcohol and not so much the gambling when I left the army, but you know, I'd get bouts of anxiety and phone up my friend and say, we need to go out.
Yeah.
That was my way of escaping it. Yeah. And I remember sitting at home one day and looking up at my wardrobe and imagining myself hanging.
Oh, wow.
And at the time I was living out of a bedroom and I just thought, what on earth's wrong with you? Why are you thinking of that? You're crazy, man.
Yeah.
Back to watching EastEnders.
Yeah.
And it started to happen more often. And then I was thinking, why on earth are you thinking about that? Sort of engaging in a conversation with myself. And then just putting it down to, you know, maybe I'm just something I'm eating, you know, is having a crazy effect on me. And then I remember one morning getting out of the shower and putting on my bathrobe. And as I tied the belt, a voice or something in my head looked down and said, just tie a knot and a loop in that belt and just hang it from your wardrobe just to see what it would look like. Or put it around your neck, just sat in the bathroom, just to see what it would feel like.
Mm.
And I remember sort of snapping out of it and thinking, why were you contemplating listening to that voice? And I'd sort of battered it off as this isn't happening. And I didn't really understand it. I didn't, you know, I still wasn't aware that I was suffering from anxiety and depression. And it started happening more often. And I was, every time it happened, I would stand there a little bit longer. And I would, you know, I'd go into the bathroom at 6 o'clock in the morning and by the end of it, I'd come out and think, how have I been in there for 45 minutes? And I'd realise that I'd started spending time, just stood there, finding myself in a daze with the rope in my hand. And it scared me because wow. I thought, you know, is my part of my brain had gone off on a tangent and yeah. there wasn't anything I could do.
Yeah, yeah, helpless to it.
Helpless to it. And my family had said for a long time that I was suffering from like depression and anxiety. Yep. And I'd always continually battered it off about going sure. to get some help because I didn't know that that was what I needed. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And there was a team of lawyers working with me to secure a settlement. And they used to take they'd catch up with me and they'd say, okay, explain to us what's been going on and how you've been feeling. And I remember just saying, oh, I've been having crazy thoughts about hanging myself and imagining it. Like, it's nuts. It's crazy. Like, I said it like very off the cuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember looking at them and they were all, and I was thinking,
why are they looking at
me? I was like, guys, calm down. It's only a joke. And they were stern-faced.
Yeah.
And then they said, a care worker I had at the time, she said, you need to go and see someone. I said, go and see someone for what? And she was like, these thoughts.
Yeah.
You know, this is serious.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It was so lonely, this lonely feeling, thinking, it's happening to me. I'd heard about it, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, sure.
But it's happening to me. And I remember thinking, I didn't want to leave the room because when I did, I knew it was me and this voice in my head.
Yeah.
And I wasn't sure I was stronger than it. And they very quickly found me a neuropsychologist who, you know, the only thing I asked was that they understood the military mindset because no one outside of the army sure. did. No one got me
no.
in the way that squaddies did or the MO did.
Sure.
And it was a tough, I think I waited about 2 weeks for my appointment and it was probably the scariest 2 weeks of my life because
yeah.
these thoughts were going on and I was trying to bury them and at the same time thinking, well, if I'm suicidal, what else isn't as it seems?
Sure, sure.
And I sort of went to ground at work and said, you know, I don't know what's going on here.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to see someone. Mm-hmm. You know, I need a bit of time.
Sure.
And I went to see the psychologist. I had to go to Canterbury, which I was sort of thinking, why Canterbury? And they were like, that's the only psychologist who's got any experience with the forces. And I thought, well, if he's going to help me, then that's what I need sure. to do.
Canterbury is.
And I remember going to see him and he, you know, done the therapist thing, sat there. So tell me, David, mm-hmm. what's been going on? And I was speaking and it was almost as if those suicidal thoughts or that part of my brain wouldn't allow me to speak about it. It had sort of, you know, buried it and said, yeah. it's fine, you don't need to mention that. It's yeah. not a problem, it's yeah. just, you're just having a bit of a few crazy thoughts.
Yeah.
And I remember, I think it was towards the end of the session, I think I'd sort of said to him, like, what are suicidal thoughts? And, you know,
yeah.
Well, will you tell me, what do you think suicidal thoughts are? And I remember speaking to him about it. And that was when it became not real for me. He said enough for me to realise that something wasn't right in me and that, but then not enough for me to feel safe or.
Yeah.
And so he said, this is what I want you to do. I want you to work Mondays, Wednesdays and Fridays, 8:30 till 12. You go back to your boss, you tell him that, mm-hmm. we'll start there. And I was sort of like, I can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
He'll fire me. Yeah, it was just showing a sign of weakness.
Yeah.
You know, what about medication? And he said, you know, you don't need to take medication. And yeah. I don't remember, but thinking, you know, isn't that what, you know, that's what helps in these situations. That's what's going to take it away today.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, unfortunately,
it just masks it. It doesn't.
And I didn't know it at the sure. time. And he said, I also want you to keep a diary. And I was sort of thinking, okay, what type of a diary? And he mm-hmm. said, at the end of each day, I want you to write about your day. everything, you know, how you felt, what was going on. And
as honest as you can.
Yeah, and I said, how is keep, you know, with all due respect, how is keeping a diary like a girl going to stop me killing myself?
Yeah.
I was thinking, like, I've come all the way to Canterbury.
And you're telling me to.
And you're telling me to tell my boss I can only work a couple of hours a week. And you want me to write a diary. And his response was, if you can get to 30 days consecutive journaling, you'll have the answer to those questions. And I remember leaving thinking, like, feeling incredibly unsafe. And I went to my GP the next day and I said to her, I'm suicidal. And she was like, tell me about it. And I was telling her what the thoughts I was having, and she gave me a leaflet. And she was like, if it gets really bad, you need to phone this number. And I was like, well,
how bad does it have to get?
How, like, how do, you know? And I explained to her that I couldn't control this.
Yeah, yeah.
And she said, well, look, if I'm honest, I don't think it's that serious. And I was sort of like, are you kidding me?
Yeah,
like,
sure.
I'm telling you that I can't, as hard as I try,
without walking in with a noose around your neck already.
Yeah.
How serious do you want to get?
And I said, you know, I've gone to see a psychologist and he's telling me to keep a diary. Mm-hmm. You know, I need some more help. And she said, I'll refer you, but it could take up to 12 weeks.
Fucking hell.
But if it get, you know, here's a telephone number. And so I remember going home that day sort of not giving up, but feeling like
deflated.
You know, yeah, completely deflated, and I don't know what's going to happen next. Sure. And at a loss. And I remember going to work and trying to have that conversation with my boss, is saying I'm not enough.
Yeah,
you know what it was this is what I'm capable of, and I have to reduce to this. But to me, it was I'm not enough.
Sure,
you know, look at me. I'm not capable. You know, I have a disability, and I am everything that Hedley Court said. Mm-hmm. And I really struggled with it. And then I was seeing the psychologist it was twice a week to begin with. And I think it took about 6 weeks of him saying to me, you know, suggesting life changes, mm-hmm. and then me actually being able to implement them. It took me about 3 weeks to say to my boss, I can't do it.
Yeah.
I can't work.
Yeah.
5 days a week. I can't even work 3 full days a week.
Yeah.
And I was very grateful that his response was, I'd rather have you 3 half days than not at all.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, and that relieved an unbelievable amount of stress on me, because I thought,
huge.
Well, if I don't have a job and I've not got money coming in.
Yeah.
And then I eventually got up to 30 days consecutive journaling. And I remember going back to see the psychologist and saying, you know, I've made it, I've done it. You know, but nothing's happened. And he said, what's going on? What's different? And I said, well, people are looking at me funny. And I've become very, almost, not a little bit paranoid. And he said, tell me about it. And what I'd get on the train to go to work, and I'd be looking down at my suit thinking, have I got food or toothpaste on me? Because people are looking at me funny. Mm-hmm. And I started to get emails and opportunities popping through on my phone and that were like, good, amazing opportunities. And I was thinking, I said to him that I felt that something bad was about to happen to me, that I was about to have a seizure or a fit.
Right.
And that was the reason all of this good was coming to me, because to make up for the bad.
Yeah, to balance.
And that people were looking at me funny because, you know, I was acting weird. And he said, no, he said, as a result of the journaling, you've changed the way you view your life, or you're beginning to change the way you view your life. And that in turn is changing the way you live your life and how other people see you. He said, you know, embrace it. Nothing bad's going to happen to you. Mm-hmm. You know, if you feel like you want to take these opportunities within reason and balance, you know, take these opportunities, see what happens. And I remember sort of, I didn't believe it at all. I was thinking, he was sort of speaking about energy, and I was thinking, oh my God, like, this is ridiculous.
Yeah.
And the next sort of 6 months are a bit of a blur for me. I don't really remember what happened. I remember coming out the other side and suddenly thinking, I don't know how this journaling is working, but it's working. And I started to think, if this has done this for me, what else is out there?
Sure.
And so I, for the first time in my life, started reading books. And this might sound silly to some of the listeners, but, you know, things come to me now in life. It's the weirdest thing. Mm-hmm. And my first book come to me because I was at work listening to Radio 4, which I've never, ever listened to, only because my boss has it tuned into the car.
Sure.
And there was a gentleman on there called Nick Littlehales, who wrote a book called Sleep.
Right.
And it was sort of based around the British cycling team when they won all their golds. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, maybe that's an area where I can educate myself because sleep's hugely important for me.
Yeah.
And so I brought the book and I read it and, you know, I started implementing the stuff that I was reading about and disregarding anything that didn't work.
Yeah.
And sort of adopting anything that did.
Yeah.
And then books were, you know, coming at me from other people randomly would say, out of nowhere, you should think about reading this book. And it was Eckhart Tolle, The Power of Now. Mm-hmm. And then people started supporting me, you know. Coming out of the woodwork, and this is where my speaking come from.
Do you think it's more like the power of attraction, positive attraction?
I sit here and I say it's all rubbish. It's, you know, what sorcery is this? But it continues to happen in my life, and I'm not doing any. You know, I'm not consciously doing
anything.
No, not consciously at all. You know, every day I try to leave a positive imprint.
Footprint. But do you think maybe subconsciously you are because of the positive steps that you're making and all the positive things you're surrounding yourself with, whether it be books, music,
it's all manifesting. Yeah. And, you know, and the psychologist soon after added, I also want you to write three things you're grateful for in a day, three things that are nice about your day, and three good deeds that you had done.
Okay.
And at the beginning, it was sort of, you know, grateful for, what am I grateful for? Food.
Sure.
It didn't rain today. Good deeds I've done. I made my nan dinner.
I opened the door for someone.
Not even that.
Yeah.
You know, I was struggling to actually see that I'd done any good. And
yeah.
I didn't understand it at the time. But what happened was, you know, after a period, I thought, I can't keep, you know, what else could I be grateful for other than food or coffee? Or, you know, I can't just do good deeds opening other doors. What other good could I do?
Yeah.
And it sort of went from a conscious thing to a becoming a subconscious thing. And so everywhere I go in life, you know, whoever I meet, it's always, you know, good afternoon, good morning, how are you? And that was where people started, you know, support from other people started to come in life because I give the example sometimes when I deliver talks of if I go into a coffee shop and someone's wearing a name tag, I say, good morning, Sarah, how are you? And they always look at me like, they'll go, how do you know my name? I'm like, you're wearing a name tag, Sarah. And they're like, oh, God, of course I am. No one ever uses my name.
Yeah.
And I'm like, how are you? How was your weekend?
Well, it brings it more back to a normal human like interaction.
Just opposed engaging.
To you're providing a service.
It
brings it to a human level almost.
Because, you know, I and it's not about, I don't do it because I want to make that person feel special
sure. or
so that I can get home and say that. Initially, it was so I could get home and say, that's a good deed done.
Yeah.
But then I started to see the benefit, like the power of, that person would smile, and that would make me smile and feel good.
But then it probably becomes a routine, right? A normal daily routine.
After 30 days of doing it, it just becomes embedded in you, like much of what we do in the army. And so that's where the support from other people, I believe, started to manifest back to me. Like my psychologist said, you know, the person you are and the energy you're putting out is coming back to you. And I still, the cynic in me says it's sorcery, it's not true. but I can't deny it because I'm now surrounded and my life is all about, you know, it's not just about me, you know, it's one of my strongest values is to not discount anyone and whoever I meet, you know, I don't walk down the road or sit on the underground talking to people. Hi, how are you?
Yeah.
You know, but if I'm interacting with someone, you know, if I walk through a door, I'll look behind me and if it doesn't matter how far, if anyone's walking towards that door, I'll stay and hold it.
Mm.
And it completely transformed not only the way I saw my life, but how I lived it, but more importantly, how I saw the adversity that I faced day to day as a result of my injury. And and this is why I say that the battle with that suicide and, you know, not feeling like I was good enough and not having to come to terms with the fact that I wasn't okay.
Yeah.
Sort of was what for me sparked and turned my life around, because had I not have had that, I could have very easily have stayed in that negative cycle.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, had I not have known those solicitors who sent me to see that specific psychologist, I could have ended up on medication.
Yeah.
But my life, you know, after the introduction of the journal and then this view of what else is out there that's going to do this to me. So sleep, I looked at sleep. I started, mm-hmm. he introduced me to a mindfulness technique mm-hmm. where I can put myself to sleep whenever I want. And what that does for 15 minutes is it takes the edge off of my mental fatigue and is the difference between me sitting on the sofa, unable to get myself up to make dinner and mm-hmm. getting up and make dinner, tidy the kitchen, sit back down and feel good that I've achieved something. And so I'd sort of spent the last, God, it would have been since 2014 I started seeing the psychologist. Since then, 12 to 14 was just denial and uh-huh. complete unawareness, which I think every single person goes through.
Sure.
But then 14 was sort of my rebirth. And
acceptance.
Yeah, accepting that, you know, I started to recognize anxiety and say, well, that's why I was going out and drinking. Not because I was an alcoholic, but mm-hmm. because it numbed that feeling of anxiety.
Self-medicated it, yeah.
Yeah. And actually, I don't need to do that anymore. And I gave up drinking. And, mm-hmm. I started to see that, you know, going out with my friends, I can't just go out and have a drink. Mm-hmm. It's not possible. Mm-hmm. Because one drink is the catch, and then I lose control.
Yeah.
And I wake up the next day regretting it. And so I managed to stop drinking, and I started reading all these books and trying out new things. And it meant that when my anxiety rears its head, which it does, you know, palpitations or panic mm-hmm. attacks, or, and I don't know the reason, mm-hmm. you know, well, I have an understanding of it, but sure. I'm able to look back and say, and in the moment and say, well, this is anxiety. You know, I've suffered a brain injury. Mm-hmm. I continue to push myself and operate on the edge of my cognitive ability. Yeah. So that's the reason for my anxiety. Now, it doesn't necessarily take the anxiety away, but it makes it bearable and it's understandable.
Yeah.
And, you know, the low moods mm-hmm. and the mornings I wake up and I don't feel...
On your game.
On my game. That I'm able in that moment to go, okay, that I, you know, looking back, you know, my journal, this is why I'm feeling this way. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. going to bed at 12 o'clock when my bedtime is set at 11 o'clock, you know, has obviously had an impact. I need to make sure I don't do that tonight.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it my life burst into colour, and the speaking come about, and I was at a military event and was asked to stand up and speak about my experiences. And, you know, I just stood up and spoke about my experiences, and people started saying you should do it for a living. And I was like,
no. You 100% have a knack for it, just a natural ability.
And the funny thing is that, you know, before my accident, even after my accident, mm-hmm. I was that grey man as a result of my upbringing that mm-hmm. couldn't speak. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't have any confidence in myself, my own ability. And I'm not sure that even without the accident, I would have generated in the army. I think I always would have been an introvert, mm-hmm. slightly introverted individual. Mm-hmm. But this is what people say. And I'm sat there thinking, I don't know how.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I've had no training.
But it's happened.
It's just happened, you know, and I don't know why. I guess it doesn't really matter.
No.
You know, I'm grateful for it. And I thought, well, okay, what I would love to do is start a speaking company that I could grow to a point where I could provide work for other mm-hmm. injured veterans who have got, you know, as you said earlier, incredible stories of overcoming adversity. If I could provide myself and others, you know, meaningful employment, certainly in London you could charge, you know, an hour talk is, you know, upwards of £4,000. We only need to do one of those a month. So if I can get, you know, three of us doing that, you know, I'd be happy. And so I thought, well, let me, I didn't believe that anything was going to, I didn't think I could get paid, let alone help others. And I started offering talks initially for free. And I remember sitting down and stressing over PowerPoint. I'd never used PowerPoint and trying to cognitively put it all together, take my story. And, and I'd had, again, people who were popping out wanting to support me. And then I started to get traction and I started to get bookings. And then I thought to myself, well, I need to, I want to do more than this. Going and doing talks is great, but is it helping people? You know, it's very short-lived. And I thought, well, why don't I offer up the tools that I've used to find success that my psychologist has helped me, that like the journaling, the sleep, the mindfulness, the gratitude. And I wasn't sure if the cynic in me said, you know, it's sorcery. It's just, you know, your psychologist isn't right. You know, he's just tricking you. You're tricking yourself. And you're going to go and trick other people and you get caught, you know, you get found out. And so I put together what I call the well-being package, that's sort of my story thread throughout. And I'm able, through my story, to demonstrate why these tools were introduced to me, how I used them, this, my struggles with them, my disbelief, but then also the success that I found as a result. And I'd approached a number of charities, supporting wounded veterans initially let me roll, sort of speak informally about the exercise. And everyone was as cynical as I was. You know, yes, I had a cool story, but everyone had a cool story. And then I remember a year, eight months later, I was away on a skiing trip with them and a gentleman by the name of John Bow sort of called me up. He said, Mo, come up to my room. I've got something for you. And I was thinking, Squaddy's got something for me. It's only going to be one thing, you know. And I've sort of knocked on the door and stuck for, I'll stick my head around the door first.
Before going in.
To make sure, to make sure he's dressed. And he said, come in. He said, sit down. He said, I've made this for you. And I was like, what? Like, he's big on bushcraft. Right. Shout out to John if you're listening. And he'd made me a leather journal holder. Like from hand. And I was like, John, this is amazing. Thank you so much. But why, you know? And he said, I took on the journaling and it's changed my life. And I just wanted to say thank you. And I was like, are you kidding me? You, like, why didn't you say anything to me? And he said, because I didn't believe in it at the start. And, you know, I had a couple of dark periods and I just picked it up. And although he does it in a slightly different way to how I do, you know, he said it's changed my life. And I just wanted to say thank you. And it was at that point where I thought, okay, maybe, you know, maybe this can help. And I continued approaching other charities and no one else was interested. And I'd sort of put it to bed and thought, let me roll it out to maybe corporate companies. And being a one-man band, you know, I didn't have contacts and I was struggling to get it out
there.
You
need to build your name, reputation as well. In order to take you seriously.
And so I then, I think a couple of, probably a year later, a year and a half later, you know, I caught up with Emma Willis and I said, look, I've got this wellbeing package. I give her a very brief description of what it was. Can I deliver it to a few veterans? And I'd said it to her 8 months prior, but it sort of got lost in transmission with everything else that was going on. And I said, look, can I have a coffee with you just to explain what it is? And I managed to get a coffee for her and with her. And I explained it to her and she said, let's do it. I said, look, I'll put on a trial workshop and could you help me find a venue? You know, that's all we need, a venue. And she said, okay, well, look, I'll pay for the veterans, their travel into London to try and get a bit of buy-in. And that was it. And we were off, and Waverton Investments provided Staff Soldiers with a space, who coincidentally happened to be sponsoring the charity that year. And one workshop turned into three, and three turned into six, and six turned into 10. And the feedback I was getting back was, we were getting back, was incredible. And I was thinking, maybe this is, you know, rather than providing employment, maybe providing these tools is the way to go. And we weren't, you know, it wasn't changing the lives of every veteran. You know, there was eight veterans would come to the workshops. There was lunch put on by Waverton, and it was a really informal environment. More of a discussion and me speaking about it than standing up briefing them. And the people started reporting back, these incredible, you know, Corey Mapp, who won gold at the Winter Championships. You know, I jokingly said to him, "Corey, you know that was because of my journaling." And I was laughing. And I said, "I won't take all the glory."
And but, he went, that gold medal over here.
You know, he went, "David, no, this has made a massive impact on my life, if not my sporting life, but my life at home. And that's allowed me to concentrate more on my training."
Almost like positive feedback loops.
It starts to snowball like it, you know, like it did in my life. And John Bowe started up his own company, and he I think he no longer has his PTSD dog. And it's to see others on a similar journey, like transition that I was, is what's driven me to just keep pushing on and pushing forward with this. And
so is that where you're at now?
So I'm now, the last workshop was in January. And then I sat down with Emma and said, "Look, what would you like to do with this going forward?" She'd said to me, she would love to take the workshops around the country, particularly to veterans who are in areas, you know, where they're not able to travel into London. It's a big thing for them.
Because
we'd had quite a few veterans who had never left Manchester. For years, and coming into London was quite traumatic for them.
Well, you know, you get in your comfort zone and it's difficult to break it.
And so, you know, I'd said, "Look, I'm more than happy to run with that. You know, I'll get in touch with April, Crystal. Sorry, Crystal, who works with Emma, and I'll get all of the addresses and I'll geographically map our database. And then if you're happy to give me contacts in those areas, you know, I can try and find venues." And so it then again, my life is just snowballing in a new direction. And I'm now, as I said to you earlier, my plan for the next 12 months is to not only roll those workshops out and reach as many veterans as I possibly can, but also deliver an inspirational talk to every single secondary school in London. Because it's aside from the veteran community, I'm super passionate about helping underprivileged children who, like me, didn't have
the greatest start.
The greatest start, and the, you know, I didn't have the worst start, but I don't, you know, growing up in areas where crime is normalised now, London's a very different place, and if I can be that role model, like the cadet leader or Captain Ireland was for me to someone else, then maybe it can help them.
Because sometimes all it takes is just for you to say the right thing at the right time in someone's life, and it takes a whole new direction.
Well, I remember, you know, the we were on an indoor range with little 2.2 rifles at cadets, and I remember hitting the cadet leader for a joke put a 50 pence piece up on the bench and said, "If anyone hits that, they can have the 50p and a free chocolate bar from the NAFI." And I somehow managed to hit it. And I remember him coming up to me and patting me on the head and saying, he nicknamed me Eagle Eye because of my bleary stare. And he said, "You're a good lad." And that's a defining point in my childhood. And although, you know, I didn't join the army till many years later, that was, if I can do that for
100%.
For someone else, you know, be it a young man or woman in secondary school who's lost and struggling, or a veteran who you know, who's lost his way.
Sure.
Because of, you know, unbelievable injury.
Yeah.
And adverse, you know, things going on around him, then so be it.
It's brilliant. Your vision and where you want to be, you know, especially the short term, in the next 12 months. I mean, I take my hat off to you. What is it? How many schools, roughly?
Well, I think I need to narrow in on the numbers.
Sure.
Between 150 and 500. And that's literally hot off the press.
Yeah.
That was, you know, it's something I wanted to do. And yesterday I committed to that, and I will in 12 months deliver to every high school. So if you're a high school head teacher or a teacher listening, you know, get in contact.
We're coming for you.
Get in contact with me. You know, there's no cost for this talk.
Well, in 12 months' time, we'll get you back here and we'll...
How scary.
We'll take it from
to
there.
Live up to it now.
Yeah.
But, you know, and this is... I do very little driving in my life,
yeah,
as far as pushing it in a direction. This is, you know, setting these challenges for myself is very new for me. And the one thing I do know is that it's as important to allow it to grow organically,
sure,
than trying to say, you know, this is about me creating
an empire,
yeah, or saying, you know, I need to earn this amount of money. You know, it's just about, you know, let me go out and inspire 150 to 500 school,
yeah,
secondary schools, and see what happens.
Yeah, yeah,
you know,
sure, 100%.
Because, you know, to be able to say I've done that.
Well, what's the worst going to happen?
I inspire thousands of children, you know.
Yeah.
Or I bore thousands of children, one of the two.
Yeah, well, they are kids, aren't they? But, mate, what you're doing is brilliant. And like I said, I will do anything I can to try and facilitate or nudge it in the right direction, or even just help out where I can.
Thank you.
With the people that I'm connected to as well, because let's face it, we should all be helping each other out and connecting people with the right
contacts. This is a prime example of what I say, people pop up in my life and,
sure,
you know,
but the thing is,
happy to help. And
this
and
wouldn't have happened if you hadn't accepted.
No, and of course, I think my advice to anyone out there is, you know, happiness is like an orgasm. If you think about it too much, it evades you, you know.
Yeah.
And actually, if you're prepared to help other people and give a little bit of yourself to other people, not all the time, you know, maybe in return, you know, you'll get a little bit of help.
Yeah.
And as a result, happiness too. Yeah. And it's magical and it's hard to believe, yes, I know, but...
No, I'm fully on board with you. And in fact, some of the things you mentioned about the mindfulness, I've just started getting into mindfulness and the diary, the journal. So when I sort of forced myself to go to DCMH, the mental health sort of wing within the military, between, I think it was my second and third tour, the psychiatrist actually told me to write a journal because I had very anger issues. I was very angry.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, what the fuck am I, why am I writing a journal? That wound me up itself.
It is so hard to get your head around.
Just leaving the ward pissed off. And I was like, you're supposed to be helping me. I'm fucking pissed off. So I'd leave the ward and then I'd have to write down, it fucking pissed me off because I have to write this. But literally, maybe day 24, 25, I found that I wasn't exploding at the smallest things, because previously, I'd explode, I'd have to write the incident, I'd have to write my feelings prior, my feelings during, my feelings after, and what I could have done better to have a positive outcome in that situation. And towards the end of that 30, literally that 30 days, there wasn't anything to write about apart from positive things. And I literally went back then, I said, I'm not getting angry. And he was just like, well, fuck off then.
I struggle with the journaling sometimes, but I think I'm on 87 days consecutive journaling. And whenever I get anywhere near 30 days, between 22 and 30, something always magical happens in my life.
Yeah.
So just before Christmas.
When you say that, and it's like the area I said that.
Just
last
before
week.
Christmas, it was the TED Talk.
Yeah.
This side of Christmas, it was me being able to commit to to speaking full time, and the opportunities presenting themselves. I didn't go looking for these opportunities. You know, they came to me, which, you know, and that was around, I think that was the 56th day when all of this happened. And well, look, I'm coming up to 90 and I'm here.
Yep.
You
100%,
know.
Yeah.
And well, we'll see where we are when we get to 120. Nothing surprises me anymore, because it just continues to happen. And if I stop journaling, it stops.
Yeah.
So
sure.
You know.
Well, you are an inspiration to go through what you went through and having the courage to go and seek help as well.
But I don't know if it was courage.
Necessity.
I think I was scared. I don't think it's not about being strong, or I just think that all of the stars aligned for me at that moment, and I was in a place where I said, okay, I will go, because my family had been saying, go, you need to see some help.
Yeah.
And I had psychological support through DCMH and Andy Court, and it had done nothing to bring this to the surface. That wasn't because it was the wrong treatment. It was what I believe just the wrong time in my life.
Sure.
I think that there's a very small window, unfortunately for humans, where it can be caught. And I was just very lucky, you know, that it was in that window.
Yeah,
because had I not have had it, who knows? I cannot confidently say that without seeing the psychologist when I did, that I wouldn't be the person I am today.
No way.
I would have gone backwards and medicated, and who knows, you know, I'd probably be on benefits. And
but the problem is, well, not the problem is, the positive thing is you took those steps and it's catapulted in the right direction.
It has, you know, it's still up and down. And,
of course.
But that's life,
yeah,
you know.
Of course.
To have the life I have, you know, even stripped to the bare minimum, with my injury, I'm happy. Mm-hmm. So that's enough, because it could be a hell of a lot worse.
100%. 100%. And not only that, the feeling of content is quite hard to find nowadays, I think, what with pressures to make it big, make big money and materialistic things.
Like you said about the journaling, you know, it strips everything back to... You have to look at who you are today.
Mm-hmm.
And if today's a bad day, well, today's a bad day.
Yeah.
Tomorrow could be a good day. And so... It's not about, you know, I need to get my speaking to a point where I've employed 10 veterans.
Sure.
And I need to speak to 100 schools by, you know, in 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's who am I today, and what am I doing to support myself and support what I want to achieve? You know, and then tomorrow, let me look back and see what I could do differently tomorrow
to improve it.
To improve myself and what I'm achieving and putting out.
Yeah. Dude, it's been awesome. It's been such a good podcast.
Thank you so much.
No worries.
Truly grateful.
No worries. And like I said, I'll do what I can to try and...
No, and likewise.
...throw the right people your way. And maybe you never know where it goes. Yeah, it's been an inspiration. It's been brilliant.
Super.
And I'm going to come to one of your talks.
You must do. I spoke yesterday to a load of Hassle Cavalry recruits. And... I done the mindfulness. I took them through the gratitude journaling and then the sleep hygiene. And I was doing the mindfulness, and one of the cocky young lads at the front sort of looked up and said, so you're telling me you're going to put me to sleep? And I said, well, I don't know that you're going to fall asleep, but, you know, it might happen. And so I take them through a body scan exercise that my psychologist took me through. And the whole room pretty much, and it always happens, whether it's corporate companies, veterans, at least 2/3 of the room fall asleep. And then I finish with, you know, it goes on for about 15 minutes. I allow them to sleep. And then I say, you know, when you're ready, bring your attention back to the room quietly, back into your body. And that same kid that gobbed off at the beginning, he was the first person to pop up and go, what on earth did you just do to me? How did you do that? And I do it to demonstrate that you know, that script that I use on myself, you take that home, you can have that impact on yourself or anyone else, you know, at any point. And, you know, to be able to do that, and maybe, you know, I have the pleasure of coming in and doing a mindfulness session for you all to give back a little bit.
That sounds brilliant.
The podcast team. Brilliant. You all then go, holy crap, how on earth has he done this? What have you done?
Yeah, hypnotized us. Dude, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it.